नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स अपारुतादे संगमतस्स तावराये सुरवन्ता बमुञ्चन्तु सतां So this take this opportunity to address the Sangha, and of course everyone wants to know how I'm feeling on my return visit. People are curious. Been away about nearly 4 years, and living in Thailand in a very different environment than here. But the practice, consciousness and space are the same wherever you are. That doesn't change. So space, consciousness. This is a reflection on the way things are. Because space is here and now, consciousness is here and now. It's immediately accessible and it doesn't depend on any condition or situation, any geographical location, but it is recognizable, and that's what in mindfulness practice we recognize the way things are. So what I'm doing now is recognizing that which is universal rather than personal or conditioned. But the modern, but society and the delusions of, that we create out of the four elements, earth, fire, water, and air elements. We create our personality, our sense of our, we have feelings, we have perceptions, we have cultural conditioning, social attitudes, biases, prejudices, assumptions that we acquire through the conditioned world. And then we recognize that the bodies we have, the thoughts we have, the emotions that we experience are dependent on other conditions, you know. So your conditions have changed from Thailand to England, from Wat Pa Ratanawan to Wat Pa Muruwati, and there's a knowing of this. The conditions are not, they're similar, some, but change. We're in a traditional form, so there's a continuity in that style. But in terms of this reality, there's the knowing of the condition. So this is a Buddhist teaching. It's pointing to the nature of phenomena as impermanent. So we have this continuous refrain in the meditation of Sankara, Sape Sankara Anicca, all conditions are impermanent. So I've been practicing with this. This will be my 48th Pansa, 48th Vasa this year. It'll be 49 if you count my Samanera, first year I was a Samanera. So that's quite a lifetime of an occasion, an opportunity to practice and put into effect the Buddhist teaching. So this evening we chanted the Dhammajakka Pavattana Sutta, which is the first sermon the Buddha gave to the five disciples in Saranat, and it's the Four Noble Truths. So this has always been my continuous interest through these 48, 49 years, is a reflection on this teaching. And of course, one becomes interested in Buddhism through something. It triggers off some kind of sense of affinity, or something in us kind of recognizes there's something to it. When I first encountered Buddhism. It was in Japan when I was in the military. So this is like the Japanese Zen approach that was available at that time, 1955. And it, something in that way of reading, you know, a translation in English, created something, stimulated this interest in this particular teaching, this religion. And what it was, I still don't know, except that since then, I was 21 at the time, up till now I'll be 80 in July. This has been my main and really only interest. So it's like an intuitive, I call it an intuitive awakening. At the time I didn't know what it was. It's strange, you know, suddenly 21-year-old sailor, American sailor, Japan in 1955 was not the Japan of the present day. It was poor, and American sailors were generally noted for getting drunk and seeking sensual pleasures. And so this was, I also indulged in a bit of this, but the real memorable occasion was this kind of sudden interest, maybe an acknowledgement of something that I couldn't, you know, really put into words at the time. So much of my life has been something I can't describe, you know, because it isn't about, you know, a personal approach so much as an awakening to what we, in Theravada and Pali terms, of Dhamma, awakening to, as Venerable Tita Dhammo, we were talking this afternoon, the natural order. Or reality, awaken to reality. So this is available to all of us. It's nothing like a special event that I'm some specially special person with special opportunities. I've always considered myself quite ordinary. And so, but this awakening I consider happened when I was about 21 years old. Now, the opportunities after that were, I didn't know what to do, didn't really understand what had happened, but the growing interest in Zen Buddhism, especially on the West Coast, the home port for our ship was San Francisco. And so at that time, there was this, Alan Watts had written a book called The Way of Zen. It was even a bestseller, Book of the Month Club type of book. And and D.T. Suzuki's works in English were being republished at that time. And there was this interest in, particular in Zen Buddhism. Of course, a lot of it was a bit kind of fashionable at the time, faddish, or, you know, it tends to have a new way of looking, a new way of thinking, and it becomes an interest or a fashion for the moment. But for many of us, it was also much more than that up to this point. That brings me to this particular event here and now. And then from that time, I've been very fortunate. When I look back at my life, I think this is the most wonderful life I've had, because I've been able to understand, to use the tools that Buddha provided, to have good guidance, good teachers, and excellent opportunities for cultivation. And for this, of course, I'm forever grateful, because it, you know, in terms of my own personality, my cultural background, my social background, none of this would fit into those particular perceptions. I was brought up as a Christian, very ordinary, white, middle class, American family, and you know, the whole attitude of you know, from the 1930s, 40s, 50s was kind of the formation of my personality and emotional habits. But there's something much more than just this personality or these conditioned emotions or cultural conditions or social attitudes or civilization or whatever you want to call it. We're open to universal consciousness. And this is what, you know, consciousness is not something that's personal. It's not, I can't claim it as my consciousness, because it's a universal reality. It has no boundary. It's not, it's reality though. We're all experiencing it this moment. But we may not have any recognition of it as consciousness, because our whole habit formation is around identity with our physical body, with our personal preferences, our emotional habits, our cultural conditioning, social conditioning, religious conditioning, generations. You know, like I'm from I feel like a Neanderthal throwback half the time, living with people who are much younger than I am, who, you know, think in a very different way than I do. Because this is the conditioning process. It's generational, isn't it? And then the kind of expectations, assumptions one formed in my generation, when my character was being formed, have changed considerably to the present day. To the present day, you find society, at least this is my perception of it, as very confused, because nobody knows who they are, what they're doing. It's all about ideas, about personal feelings, about individuality, about self-expression, about me and mine, and rights and privileges, and all the rest. The whole sense of oneself is no longer a part of any other higher kind of or grander view. It's about me. And we're fascinated, obsessed with ourselves. Now, this one can see this as a criticism, but also as a point, is that this attitude is also brings forth much suffering to us. Being selfish, self-centered, obsessed with oneself is suffering, is dukkha. It's the first noble truth. And when you promote yourself above everything else, then you feel incredible loneliness, isolation, lack of feeling integrated into anything, and the kind of neurotic problems that modern people have because of this obsession with me and mine. Because when you reflect on it, you know, to be so identified with such a limited form as your own body, you know, that is miserable, isn't it? To be completely obsessed with your appearance, with your gender, with the color of your skin, your age. I mean, because what can you do about it? You've got it. It grows up, gets old, and dies. So it's just the way things are. It's a natural condition. But when we see it in terms of the perception of self, then we create suffering about it, because it's not a self. It's just another sankhara, another impermanent condition. So the Buddha emphasized the ability we have to awaken to reality or to the natural order. Awakenness, like the word Buddha itself, this Buddha Rupa here, is a reminder of that potential in all of us, just to awaken to this present moment as is. It's a conscious moment, and it's awakened to Sapay Sankaranicha, all conditions are impermanent. Now, if you really, with determination, reflect this way, after a while, you know, you understand the words. Nobody has any problem understanding all conditions are impermanent. That's quite simple. But it's not a grasping of that as some kind of doctrinal teaching. It's not something that you have to believe in. It's a suggestion, a way of looking. And that which is aware, that awareness then, is our ability to observe conditions, to observe phenomena, or observe a phenomenon changing. And that, like sati sampajanya, mindfulness, clear comprehension, intuitive awareness, apperception, that these words, English words, convey that sense of open attention in the present. It's a conscious, fully conscious, receptive to the totality of this moment as is, which includes everything, the body, the thoughts, the memories, the feelings, good, bad, right, or wrong, everything that is part of this, included in this moment, what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, think, and feel. Now, the conditioned realm is, with the conditioned, with thought, thoughts are conditioned. The thinking process is conditioned. You aren't born, a baby isn't born thinking in English or in Thai. You know. We learn the language after we're born, but a baby, newborn baby, is a conscious entity, isn't it? It has a human form, has a rupa, it has a consciousness, it has feeling, vedana, pleasure, pain, and neutral feeling. And so these are natural conditions. These are not personal anymore. I'm just pointing out in terms of the five khandhas. These are just natural conditions. They aren't like I didn't create them as a person. The consciousness I didn't create is not mine. Or feeling, pleasure, pain, personally, Ajahn Sumedho, I personally like only pleasurable feelings. That's all I want is just pleasurable feelings and pleasurable sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch, and all the rest. And I don't like the opposite. But feeling is about pleasure and pain. It's not about what Sumedho wants. It's about the way things are. And, of course, pleasure and pain are impermanent conditions. And we're aware of them. We know when we're feeling pain, it's like this, or pleasurable sensations through the senses. We know the body, we know its posture right now. It's sitting, it's like this. Sitting, standing, walking, lying down, four postures. It's like this. Sitting is like this. So I'm just noticing, awakening to the way it is as we experience it in the present moment. Breathing is like this. You go inhaling and then exhaling. You can't inhale and then inhale again and inhale again till you get tired of inhaling and then you exhale. You just have to inhale, exhale throughout your life. And when that stops, that means you're dead. But the breath is a natural condition of the body. The body is like anything else. It's like a tree, like a flower, like a mosquito, anything else. It's a conscious form. It's a natural form. It's breathing is natural. Feeling is a sense realm. It's about feeling. But what we create out of all this is a sense of a self. We limit all this and fixate it, petrify this moment with a sense of me. I am this body. I am this person. These are my thoughts, my memories, my feelings. what I like, what I don't like. And so modern society is based on this sense of a self, on our ability to create images of perfection. Like this time, you know, we have the images of how things should be if everything was perfect. Democratic, you know, the idea of democracy, you know, where everything's fair and just and everybody has a say. This is an ideal, democratic ideal that we can create. Ideas of perfection. To be totally free, a free spirit, to be ourselves and to, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of action. We want, you know, we can create these ideals, take them to the highest point that you can possibly think. But at this moment, right now, this is not an ideal, this is just the way it is. This very moment, isn't it? It's not an ideal moment, it's the reality of now, it's like this. And when I talk like this, I'm actually observing this moment is like this rather than, and it's not about whether I like it or don't like it. If those kind of thoughts or feelings arise, they're part of the present moment, but they're not grasped, they're not identified with, they're merely recognized as sape sankarani cha. Now if you pursue this to its logical conclusion, then you know, after all these years of meditation, I recognize the reality of sape sankarani cha. Nothing fantastic, is it? I mean, you know, we've been saying that over and over again. Sape tamanata, you can go that way. But it's, you know, these particular reflective pointers or teachings, don't think you understand them because you figure them out with your brain. You notice change. You know, whatever you're feeling in this present moment, there's a knowing. It's like this. It feels this way. Hot or cold or neutral. You can observe it. If you feel doubt or worry or interest or boredom with what you're hearing, is like this. You can be aware of the emotion that you're experiencing at this moment. It's like this, whatever it might be. That which is aware is not a condition. It's not a sankhara. That awareness is the gate to the deathless. So my usual reflection and is the gate to the deathless is open. And this is what mindfulness is. It's the way that we can get beyond just the limitation of the conditioning that we're kind of entrapped and bound into in this lifetime through awareness, through sati sampatthanya, and then panya, or universal wisdom, operates through this openness. You know, the panya, or wisdom, is universal. It's everywhere. It's the way it is. It's not something you get. It's something you awaken to. And the mere awakenness is letting go of the conditioned realm, not trying to destroy it, reject it, but know it in the simple reality, sape sankarani cha. Now this is all clearly in, you know, said in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the one we chanted this evening. It's all there. It's not like it's a secret teaching or especially advanced teaching. It's open to everyone. It's not, you know, you don't have to just have senior monks, senior bhikkhus, chant the Dhammajaka Sutta, you're all welcome to do it. It's open to the whole world. But it also can be a perfunctory chant. You know, Pali chanting can just be, you know, something that we do because we're Theravadan Buddhists. But it's also much more than that. It's more than just ceremonial chanting. It is a perfect teaching, really, in terms of conventional teaching. In terms of convention, you know, it's really a brilliant teaching the Buddha gave in his first sermon. Because it takes what none of us want, is a dukkha, suffering. Nobody wants it. We all like to find happiness. We'd be, have love and happiness and success and be respected prosper, all the best. You know, we'd love to have all the best. And none of us, you know, we don't like suffering, we don't want it. And so the society we live in is about seeking happiness, seeking security, seeking safety, seeking comfort, always trying to improve things, trying to get something that will make us feel more secure, more safe, more happy, more have more pleasure. So we, you know, the crazy system we're in, modern capitalism, you know, it's always presenting something new that's better than last year's model. It's an endless presentation of better things that we can always think we'd be happier, better off, more contented, more secure with the better model, the newest, the best. It's also a time where we begin to see through this. We're well enough off. We have enough of all these things to also many of us wake into the dreariness of the material world, the boredom, the endless variety, the endless choices available to us are quite dreary, quite boring in the long run, because there's never any end to them. It just goes on and on. When you get what you want, then you want something else. And if you don't awaken to that, then it just goes on and on to you. You know, you have to go to drink, drugs, all this. Why is drug addiction so common now? Or alcoholism? Or sexual obsessions? Or all these kind of, obsessions that are common now in affluent societies as they become, you know, very materially oriented and successful, and people have all these available to them. Why do we seek to get lost in drug addiction or alcoholism or various obsessions we can you know, be attached to get out of the dreariness, the dukkha of the present moment, the dreariness of our own creations, the boredom of our own thoughts, the dreariness of modern society with all its endless options and opportunities. So this is, you know, when we do get what we want, we have a momentary kind of feeling of success and happiness. You can't sustain it. It just doesn't last. You can't hold on to it. You have to have it again. You have to think of something else you want and then get that. So people, like have shopping addictions. They just go out shopping in these shopping malls, because you can always get something, you know, and you see something you want, you buy it, and then you have that momentary feeling of, I have what I want at last, and then can you sustain it? Can you keep that feeling, or does the mind drift off to the next possible attractive item that creates desire. But we can see this, you know, desire is something we can observe. And in the Second Noble Truth, it's about desire, dhanha, gama dhanha, bhava dhanha, vipava dhanha. And dhanha then this is a desire realm, you know, where our bodies are about desire, you know, therefore, procreating the species. They need to be fed. They need food. They need rest. And we have senses, so we like what is attractive to the sight, and we don't like the ugly, unpleasant sensory experiences. So there's like and don't like, want and don't want, on the sense plane. Then in monastic life and in religion in general, one of the big problems is bhava dhanna, wanting to become. How many of you want to become enlightened, want to become a stream enterer, want to attain jhanas, want to get somewhere in your practice, want to get something you don't have yet? You know, that's one of the big obstructions in our life, is wanting to attain, to achieve, to get something that we feel we don't have. So if you think, you know, I don't have enough samadhi, I've got to get something I don't have. You can observe that very feeling of being somebody who wants something you don't have yet. You create that. That's a self-creation in the mind. You have to think, I am this person who wants to become enlightened, because I see myself as unenlightened right now. And in order to get enlightened, I have to do something, meditate and practice, and then through practice, I hope in the future to become enlightened. That is a scenario that we create in our mind. And you can observe that. There's awareness of bhava dhanha, and then vipava dhanha, desire to get rid of. I've got to get rid of these defilements, these obstructions, these sinful thoughts. I've got to get rid of this ego, or this, I've got to get rid of selfishness. I've got to get rid of my obsessions in order to become something else, something you think you would like to become. Now, what I'm pointing out, and this is all a self-create, we create this with our thinking process. These are sape sankarani cha. They're conditions, but they're created by us out of ignorance. They're not like consciousness or the body or feelings of pleasure, pain, neutral sensations natural to this realm. We create this artificial, these artifices that we identify and live through, this sense of a separate self, separate body, and the identity with memories that we have, with the experiences of the past, with our desires for becoming, or desires for material wealth, material pleasure, material success, for becoming a stream enterer, an arahant, or trying to get rid of our desire to get rid of our bad thoughts, our fears, our jealousies, our anger, our resentments. I don't know how many people ask me about how do I get rid of anger. You know, so in Thailand, you know, people, to show anger is really, you know, is not part of the social expectation. So many Thai women will come and say, Ajahn Sumedho, teach me how to get rid of anger, you know. So, you say, you know, you want, it's vipava dhanha, isn't it? How can I get, I'm an angry person, and I know I shouldn't be, it's bad, and I've got to get rid of it. Tell me how to do it. That's the creation of the mind. And I am an angry person. This is a bad emotion. It gets me into trouble, and I want to get rid of it. That's thinking, isn't it? It's about I am my emotions. I am this person. This anger is mine, and I don't want it. I want to get rid of it. This is created through thought. It's the world we create out of avijja, or ignorance. So this word avijja means, in Pali, it means ignorant, not understanding the Four Noble Truths. There are three aspects, 12 insights. So avijja is the cause of suffering. Ignorance is the cause of dukkha. So if you take it to the paticca samuppada, you know, dependent origination, it starts out avijja, bhajaya, sankhara, sankhara, bhajaya, vijnana. So when we always operate from I am this person, this body, I've got to get something I don't have in order to become, or I've got to get rid of these horrible feelings in order to become, or maybe just on a worldly level, I want only the pleasurable sense experiences, the beauty, the beautiful music and fragrant odors and good tastes and so forth, then we're in for disappointment. Because when we do get these things, they're not sustainable. They have no sense of being able to sustain themselves. And we can delude ourselves by endlessly trying to hold on and try to recreate them in a futile effort that only leads to despair, depression, and we take to drinking drugs in order to get away from it, or go to psychiatrists or do something to try to get rid of the sense of our lack of self-worth or our fears or our anger. But then you see, anger is a part of this realm. There's plenty to get angry about in this realm. It's a desire realm. It's about lopa dosa moha. It's about greed, hatred, and delusion. We're primed for greed. Anger is a natural emotion that is part of this realm. Delusion. Moha. Not understanding anything, just being caught in the momentum of our habits. And when they don't work anymore, when things change or alien forces influence us or situations change in a way we don't expect or don't like, then we get confused, we get frustrated, angry, worried, upset. And you can see in the politics of the present time, you know, the population pressures of the right wing kind of political attitudes are becoming popular again. Because that's like you're trying to protect, trying to hold on to what we feel safe with, because we don't like alien forces or foreign things or strange energies or the unknown coming into our lives. We like to hold on to things that we feel make us feel safe and secure in our limited identities. And so the suffering of humanity is everywhere. Now this suffering is a noble truth. It's not a curse. It's not something to see as try to get away from, but to recognize. And that's the shift from the ordinary person who doesn't awaken to anything. They're always running to find happiness, security in some form or another. Because that's the desire realm. We want the pleasure, the security, the happiness, the success. We want to be respected, want to be loved, want to feel happy. And then we're afraid of this opposite. We're afraid if we want all the positive things, then we're afraid we won't get them. We'll be failures. We'll lose everything. Nobody will love us. We'll be rejected, humiliated. We'll get sick and we'll have leprosy and nobody will want us around. And all my lovely items will be taken away from me. And I won't get anywhere in a monastic life because I've got too many emotional problems and fears and desires, and therefore we can create this sense of I can't meditate, I'm no good at meditation because of all my emotional habits. I have to get rid of these, resolve these internal conflicts before I can really get down to the real practice. This is creation of the mind, and that we do this to ourselves. Now, there's an awareness of this. If you take time to observe how you see yourself, I'm not saying to do it in terms of judgmental, in terms of judgment or criticism, but just awaken to how you regard yourself and listen to it. So you're aware of the assumptions you make, the attachments you have about who you are, what your worth is, where you are at, what you should or shouldn't be. That which is aware is not a self, isn't it? It's conscious. There's wisdom there. Wisdom can operate through consciousness if we let go of the conditions. And that's the second noble truth, let go. Ploy Wang in Thai, or Pahana. Pahana Padana is one of the efforts, isn't it, to relinquish, abandon, let go. And it's not an annihilation. It's not destroying anything. It's not saying you've got to get rid of anything. Just let go of it, which is as simple as just say, you know, I'm attached to this clock. And then Buddha says, Sumedho, your suffering is due to the attachment to this clock. Let go of it. And so I just put it down. Simple as that. I don't have to throw it away or ask one of the monks to take it away, but just put it down. Then I can use it. You know, it's a useful item. And I know when I've been talking too long and you're all bored out of your minds. So, now, it's like awakening to the way things are is not a kind of difficult thing. It's just a matter of recognizing it. It's not you have to do something in order to awaken. It's just wake up. I've got to practice really hard on my awakening. I've got this awakening practice, so I come here, sit for 5 hours, telling myself to be awake. But that's not it. It's a simple matter of here and now, the way it is. It's like this. And then there's consciousness, space. Then there's feeling. We have the body in its postures. There's the breath. There's the state of mind, you know, the kind of emotional quality or mental state you're experiencing at this moment. You might be happy, sad, interested, bored, doubtful, uncertain. But whatever it is, you're aware, it's like this. I'm not asking you to feel anything, but just awaken to sankhara. Also, you know, the Western mind is one where we try to figure out, why do I feel like this? Why do I get angry? Why do I have this obsession? Why do I have these fears? Why do I get jealous? Why do I feel sorry for myself? Why? But the Buddha never asked why. And when you look at his teachings, he didn't care about why. You don't need to know why. You just need to recognize that all conditions are impermanent. It's his pointing to the reality of conditioned phenomena, not why they are the way they are, or why you happen to be feeling this, but you're awakened to what you're feeling. Cittanupassana, awakened to the state of mind. And you don't have to know why you feel it, but it is what it is, you know, whatever it might be. It's a sankhara. It's a phenomenon. It is what it is. And it's changing. If you allow it to be, you don't try to react to it with liking or aversion. You just let it be and let it go. It'll resolve itself if you allow it to. Because all sankharas, you know, if you just put them down, abandon them, let them be what they are, they cease. Their nature is to cease. That's the way it is. So now in a couple of months, I'll be 80 years old according to the convention. I'm on the cessation side of life. You know, and in a few years, this form will cease. Like we have the body of Rojana, Kay Brown, who died. And she's now in the Chapel of Rest. This is natural phenomena. This is a natural process of a body that was born, grows up, gets old, and dies. And this is a way of, this isn't just dismissing our feelings, because when somebody dies, somebody we love, somebody we respect dies, we feel this way. You know, you feel what they call grief or sadness. Because there's a loss of the loved, of what we depend on maybe, or what we're used to, a friendship. And it's this way. So in this sense of loss, we're aware of it. This awareness of loss is like this. And it's not something you shouldn't feel this way, but whatever you're feeling is the way it is. And let it be that way so that you can let it resolve itself. The sadness of loss is impermanent and it will resolve itself if you're willing to let it be. So Ajahn, Tanajan, Virtamo and I, we have very good Dhamma discussions much of the time, because we've been on this for many years. And of course, this is, an opportunity. This lifetime I've had is such a wonderful opportunity that surprises me when I look at my life. I think I've had a fantastic life. I don't regret. I have no regrets. It's a lot of gratitude because of the Buddha's teaching. And once I put myself into that mode, in that interest, then doors open up that I never expected. I never expected to meet a teacher like Lungpo Cha. I mean, that happened out of the blue. I was hoping to find a teacher, you know, in Thailand. Didn't know a thing about Thailand when I arrived, and I thought, I've got to find a teacher, because I knew I'd gone as far as I could reading books. You know, I found that inspiring and interesting, but it didn't really change much, you know. Still, I managed to suffer around in the usual ways, even when I'm reading inspiring Buddhist suttas. So it was the Batibata, and this, of course, was Lungpo Cha's genius. He was always saying Batibat, Batibata. And this means put it into practice. It's not something you practice with, not something you just read out of the scripture, recite in a Dhammajaka chant,
and then say you understand the Four Noble Truths. We have that teaching, so that's like Bharyatitamma, isn't it? It's the study of the scripture. That's the first aspect. Bharyatitamma is the scriptural teaching, which points the way. Then Patipatta is to, like in the First Noble Truth, the scriptural teaching, there's dukkha, Patipatta, understand dukkha, and Patiwait, the result of that insight, of changing one's attitude from trying to get rid of dukkha to, it's like this. That which is aware of dukkha, then, is not dukkha. That awareness is not suffering. But it knows suffering. It's like this. And dukkha is impermanent. It arises, ceases. It's the nature of this realm. This realm is about being born, growing up, getting old and dying. It's about loss. It's about grief. It's about fear and anger and greed and delusion. This realm is the experience of these relentlessly changing conditions that we're experiencing through our bodies, through our senses, through our thoughts, our habits. But the awareness of them is the refuge. So that's when we take refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha, Putto Tamo Sangko, Bhutang Sarnangatami, Tamang Sarnangatami, Sangkang Sarnangatami. This is not personal anymore. When we're taking refuge in Buddha, it's not me. I'm not taking refuge in my version of the Buddha, but in awareness. Awakened consciousness in the present. Putto Tamo isn't taking refuge in a set of the Tripitaka, but it's recognizing Dhamma, seeing awakening to reality, to the natural order. It's awakening to the way things are. That's Dhamma, and then Sangha is practicing Supatipanno, Ujjupatipanno, the right way, direct, and so forth. Seeing, you know, you reflect, notice how the samsara world, the world that we live in, is a dangerous one. You know, how do we know we'll survive the next moment? And when a meteorite might land on top of this temple, it could happen. Well, let's not think about that. Right? Or who, you know, maybe, you know, everybody will start persecuting Buddhist monks, or you don't know what the changes might be. Maybe some alien force will come from afar and hates Buddhism and tortures us all to death. I mean, well, you can think of any scenario you want, and the blockbuster films provide you with endless variations on the theme. But the future is unknown, isn't it? You don't know. The path, what you remember now, is the knowing. It's awakened awareness, wisdom, here and now. And in refuge in Buddha Dhamma Sangha, not in your own views and opinions, personal preferences, prejudices, or whatever. So when you take, you know, so that, you know, all these years, Bhutang Sarnangachami becomes something very real for me. It's a real refuge. It's not just a ceremonial habit that you do in Theravada Buddhism, but it's, you know, I know what it is. I know how to take refuge in Bhutto Tamo Sangho through the Patipatta, through the practice, making it work. And it's, of course, here. You know, you have to see it here. You can't just, you know, copy somebody else. Nobody else can do it for you. And then Sangho is to cultivate. You know, and then in our life, in the monastic Sangha, it's a form. It's a beautiful form, a gracious form to live in for mindfulness and living within a society in which we are not contributing to its stupidity and foolishness, but we're giving opportunities for, you know, for people to hear the teaching of the Buddha, to give dana, to have a break from the madness of modern life, to maybe see something different. You know, we're something beneficial to the society here. If we're supatipanno, ujjupatipanno, and we're not here to convert or to cause conflict with other religions, or we're not here to divide society, you know, trying to create more problems for Britain because it has enough already. We're not here to add to the misery and problems of the political, social, economic problems of modern UK, but to be that which is beneficial. So, like our alms mendicancy, our making ourselves alms mendicants, depending on the good-heartedness, the generosity of others, isn't just we're trying to freeload off the society, take advantage of the natural health system, and expect good English people to come and feed us so we can do our practice. That's not what we're here for. It's an occasion for people to offer what, you know, the basic requirements for life, like food, something to wear, shelter for the night, medicine for sickness. So this, you know, is part of, like, the Thai society very much is, you know, 95% of Thai people see themselves as Theravadan Buddhists. So you've got a kind of, you know, homogenous society there. It has a very small minority groups. So you've got this Theravadan identity. A lot of it's just, you know, cultural, superficial identities because it's taken for granted, but it's available. And that for those that wake up and, you know, so even on the level of custom and tradition, ceremony, I'm not despising that in any way. It has its, you know, at least it's a container. It holds it within the society for those who, you know, at least tambun or offering dana or chanting Pali scriptures. That's something better than getting addicted to drugs and drink. And coming to the temple just to sit for 5 minutes is better than just getting lost in your fears and doubts and worries in the world. And so, I mean, at least we're offering on all levels. That's what's so beautiful about this tradition. It offers from the basic level of dana and then sila and pavana. You know, so it's not just for those who want to meditate and become enlightened, but it's also for those who don't even think of that, of just tambun, wanting to offer, share something they have with somebody else. Or those that wish to remind themselves to have some kind of structure, moral structure, limitation on behavior, such as five precepts. It's like, you're rising up, your opportunities to be a better person, a better citizen in the society are available through dana sila. And then bhavana is the those who awaken to the dukkha, the suffering of the samsaravata, this realm of desire and continuous change in which we have this opportunity and very direct teaching pointing directly here and now to the pure, like the citta is pure. You know, no matter what, even if you have impure thoughts and horrible memories, the citta is never stained by anything. You see, it's not yours. It's not, it can't be damaged. It can't be dirtied. Can't be soiled. So it's always a refuge. In mindfulness, then we actually find that. We recognize it through awareness, through letting go, through non-attachment, and through bhavana, or cultivating this way of mindfulness and wisdom. So I offer this as a reflection.
Arang dadama se sadhu, 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 anumodami.